It must say something about our time that there are quite a number of books, including the notorious bestseller, The Da Vinci Code, which point to the possibility of, or the reality of, a marriage of Jesus of Nazareth and Mary Magdalene, with various presentations of the sort of faking of the death of Jesus on the cross. And with this, then, the very distinct possibility or reality of descendants of Jesus the Christ and Mary Magdalene. Now, one would imagine that such individuals would be, of course, with such a lineage, quite saintly and looking out for nothing so much as the most beneficial effects for humanity. And yet, ironically, they're often presented as being incredibly paranoid about their lineage and not wanting anyone to know or using their special powers in a negative way. But whatever, that is something people will accept. Not the Catholic Church, obviously, but at least many, many readers worldwide would entertain such an idea or at least be intrigued by it. So, oddly enough, when Rudolf Steiner does not say that at all, he certainly ascribes to the idea that the crucifixion did take place, but when he speaks of two Jesus children, this just is so bizarre. This just really gets people going. And as I've said, that, you know, this idea of one child lives so strongly in people's etheric bodies. They've been raised on that if they are of Christian persuasion. And it's not so easy to change. So I recognize that bringing this picture at the end of the sequence on evolution is kind of a bit earth-shaking for many. And again, this is why I don't want to bring it in a superficial way, but try to develop it much further in the three lectures to which I've referred you, to which you are welcome to listen as much as you want during this course. Let me just go further with a few points about these two Jesus children and the deeds of the Christ being at this time. Steiner tells us that after age 12, the Solomon Jesus child grew ill and died, and the substance of his being and the fruits of his previous incarnations, all of this was given to the body of the Adam Cadman Jesus child, whom Steiner also speaks of as the Nathan Jesus child, coming from a slightly different lineage than the Solomon Jesus child. So now one has the combination of the deepest fount of wisdom, for Steiner has identified the Solomon Jesus child with, on the one hand, King Solomon, who he says was not only the wisest man to live on earth at his time, but in many respects the wisest man who has ever lived and ever will live on the face of the earth. And also with the flowing stream of the Zarathustra being, the greatest of the great initiates, who also, in a way, informed the being of the kingly, priestly child, the Solomon child. This is why the star hung over him. This is why the Magi, who were all Zoroastrians, Zarathustran initiates, this is why they sought him out and found him. So all of this then flows into the Nathan Jesus child, and now he must go through a profound period of adjustment in order to take on what is essentially a completely new identity. He is still Jesus, and this is something that Steiner emphasized again and again. The Christ principle as such has not yet come. We are still talking about, as it were, the body and bodies which are going to be its vehicle, which are going to be its vessel. So even this process is complex and of world historical import. Now, between ages 12 and approximately age 30, in that period of about 18 years or so, this sort of moon node period, the Gospels are quiet. There certainly are legends. There are different thoughts about this time. But it is, in a certain way, a time that has really been kind of dark in the collective memory of humanity. What happened in those years? And it was in response to this question, and out of a recognition that in our time, one has to see an entirely different dimension of these Jesus children, and now the Jesus young person who's single with the Solomon child having died. And for this reason, Steiner wrote one of his most remarkable, or spoke one of his most remarkable lecture cycles, the Fifth Gospel. One can only imagine the degree of spiritual audacity that it took, that how indicative this is, that Steiner was trying to move the esoteric into the exoteric world in a remarkably powerful way, because unlike other lecture cycles that he gave, which were only to members of the society, these were, relatively speaking, more open, and they were certainly made available to the public via stenographic transcripts. So here Steiner was being very open about this, that his own development had reached a point where he could be one of the gospel writers. He never says this, but he does say that the spiritual world recognizes the necessity of this period of the life of Jesus being brought to the fore, that this is a time that we must understand it. Now, we have to think about this, as I like to do, you know, Steiner in the context of his time, that just at this time when Steiner was giving these lectures, G. Stanley Hall, the father of psychology in the United States, a disciple of Sigmund Freud, and a man who's often felt to be the progenitor of behavioral psychology in particular, but Stanley Hall coined the word adolescence. And with this, as it were, he added another 7 years to human childhood. He really showed that there's a period approximately between 13 and 20, right up to the time of the moon node, to the coming of the ego. Of course, he didn't use those terms at all, but that there is clearly a period of time which is a continuing gestation of childhood in which the human being is going through particular states of consciousness and unconsciousness which must be understood and attended to. And here Rudolf Steiner opens the window, or at least pulls back the curtain, the veil, on the adolescent years of Jesus of Nazareth. And without trivializing this in any way, I think it's fair to say that Rudolf Steiner presents here the world's first teenager, someone who, though very likely bar mitzvahed in the temple, or having rituals akin to that at that time, nonetheless, he is not yet a man. He is going through yet another stage in which his higher and lower members of two different individualities are blending or coming together. And he is trying to find who he is, trying to search for his own identity. In the Waldorf High School, there's this wonderful formula. It sometimes becomes kind of mechanized, but nonetheless, at its basis is a great truth about this age, that the ninth grader needs to ask what. The 10th grader needs to ask how. The 11th grader needs to ask why. And the 12th grader needs to ask who. Not only who am I, but with whom do I need to work to explore further the first three questions or to act on answers to which I think I've come. And so in the fifth gospel, Rudolf Steiner takes us into the heart and soul of Jesus to see him agonizing over these questions, to see him facing, on the one hand, the incredible demonization that had occurred in the entire pagan world, how the interplay of Luciferic Ahrimanic forces in tandem with the super condensation of the earth had brought about a complete darkening and dulling of human consciousness. And there was a danger of the earth and the spiritual world growing completely asunder. He could see this out of the wisdom that he carried from ancient times and also out of the purity of the being that had only incarnated for the first time. He could also see, on the other hand, how the most developed individuals on the earth, who at that time, Steiner says, were living among the Israelites because of the Israelites' privileged, chosen, non-Luciferic existence, so that there were still Israelites who remained true to this purity of soul under the leadership of Yahweh. But the way they kept themselves pure was, as it were, by putting themselves in a gated community, the community of the Essenes. And Jesus' own parents were deeply connected to this community, and as the Dead Sea Scrolls and other relatively recently uncovered documents have revealed, much of what Jesus of Nazareth had to teach could be found among the doctrines of the Essenes. He was decidedly, definitely connected, probably had undergone the equivalent of a kind of Essene initiation, and was expected then, with his obvious capacities, to assume an important position in the Essene sect. But what he saw there was that the Essenes were able to maintain their purity by putting themselves in a walled space, and that on the outside of these walls were painted or sculpted images of Lucifer and Ahriman. Why on the outside of the wall? Because that's where they belonged. This is what ancient peoples would do. That's the gargoyles and the fierce kind of demonic figures and animal human figures that one sees on the walls of ancient cities or on the outside of buildings. It was a way of keeping them out there. And Jesus recognized that this was not enough. This was no longer sufficient just to push these beings away. You know, one might say in a modern way, not in my neighborhood, that rather these beings had to be met. If not necessarily transformed and redeemed and saved at that moment, they at least had to be met. Or else the earth would be completely under their sway. And no number of little communities of advanced souls would be able to really serve the needs not only of all humanity, but of the earth itself. And so perceiving this kind of elitist sect as one that could not really serve the salvation of all humanity and of the earth, Jesus recognized he had to go out into the world and meet these dual forces of evil in another way. And so we have the temptations, and here again Steiner is at pains to present that, you know, the temptations are from Satan and also from Lucifer, that Jesus faces Luciferic and Ahrimanic temptations, and that he is actually better able to deal with the Luciferic temptations because Lucifer is now at the end of his powers. His powers, his sway over the earth is waning. His time has come to relinquish his rule, though he won't go without a fight. But where he has to face, where Jesus must face the Ahrimanic temptations, this is more difficult. And particularly the turning of stones into bread. We might say something that food science is working on right this moment, how to take the mineral world untransformed and make it substitute for human nourishment. This is still, in a way, our task as well. And then we have the actual coming of the Christ being himself, and this is the baptism in the Jordan. And here again, as I've mentioned, the Jordan River Valley is the deepest river valley on earth, below sea level. And this is where the Christ chooses to incarnate. And even this moment of the baptism, is only the beginning of the incarnation at age 30 for Jesus. And it takes 3 years for this incarnation to fully occur, much like the incarnation of the little baby into a three-year-old who can then say, I. So this is a slow process, and it is a painful process. And if you recall what I brought earlier, here we are back again to the fourfold human being. And as Steiner describes, the incarnating of the Christ principle into the body of Jesus, here again, he gives us yet another set of revelations and teachings about the fourfold body that we carry, that the power of the ego can do a person in, that we are not presently constituted in such a way that we can carry the ego in its full force. And yet that is exactly what was happening to Jesus of Nazareth. The full force of the Christ being, which goes far beyond the human ego, but it was nonetheless the ego of the Christ being, this was penetrating his members. And I mentioned this analogy, it would be like one of us fitting ourselves into a pebble, and either we would just be completely imprisoned and paralyzed, or we would have to burst out of that pebble. We would have to pulverize it into dust so that we could assume our rightful form and being. So Steiner has brought the incredible notion that even had he not been crucified, that Jesus of Nazareth would not have lived much longer. That in much the same way that the Solomon child had to die at age 12, so Jesus of Nazareth would have died in one way or another round about 33 or shortly thereafter. Because once the ego of the Christ being, which is so majestic and so huge, fit itself fully into a human physical body, life as we know it could not go on. This would require a physical body of a completely different constitution. So why did the spiritual world do this? The spiritual world did this because otherwise the densification of the earth, the densification of the human body, was on the verge of making it completely foreign to the entire spiritual world, that only the fallen angels, we might say, would still be able to have a connection with human beings. But all of the progressive beings that still turn their consciousness towards the Godhead, they would know and understand absolutely nothing about the human being, so that we would be lost. We'd be a, you know, like one of these science fiction planetary outposts circling in the universe without any meaning or any connection. So the highest beings of all had to, in a way, condense and find their way into a human body to experience what it meant to be human. So from that point on, from the point of the baptism to the point of the crucifixion, the highest of the highest beings in the spiritual world could understand what it meant to be human. They all at that moment, in a way, had a vicarious but really direct experience of the suffering, the difficulty, the challenge of living in a human body. And in a way, that was their education. That was the high point of their learning how to reflect on themselves what they are and what they are not, and to awaken an incredible wave of empathy, of understanding, of compassion for humanity at large. But that was not enough. That was what it meant to be in a human body. That was hard enough for higher beings to understand. But there was another aspect of being human that was, of course, equally foreign to them, and that was the experience of leaving that body, of the drama, the pain, the contrast between being in that body and not being in that body. That is to say, they also had to face human death. And in a way, it had to be a death that was slow, that was prolonged, that was extremely painful, because that's what it would take for this majestic ego, which had so fully penetrated every fiber of the being of Jesus of Nazareth. It could not just, as it were, jump out. It had gone in very, very deeply, and now it would take some time and tremendous effort for it to free itself. And so we have the horrible picture of the crucifixion, which, of course, no painter to this day has really been able to reproduce in its absolute ugliness and horror. And oddly and strangely, it took that very questionable movie by Mel Gibson to try to present exactly what it probably looked like to be brought to crucifixion in Roman times. The cruelty and the prolongation of the pain. This, Steiner said, this death was the most significant thing entirely about the coming of the Christ. That it is this moment of death. This is why he speaks of the entire Christ event as the mystery of Golgotha. He said this was the great lesson for the hierarchies. This was the great schooling for the gods. And this is why one sees, more often than not, in scenes of the crucifixion, one sees from on high the entire spiritual world watching, the highest of the angels watching raptly, sometimes weeping at this deed, because this is, in a way, the sacrifice of the spiritual world going into the depths of a body, leaving that body through an earthly death experience so that the spiritual world could understand the human phase of the hierarchy of man, which otherwise would be completely strange and alien to it. And then there is, of course, the mystery of the resurrection. And Steiner speaks of this as well, and the phantom of the physical body, the mystery of the physical body, and you can go back to our discussions about that, which in a way has a new revelation here. And from this point on then, a whole complex of things are happening. On the one hand, the flow of the blood, the Christ-filled blood of Jesus of Nazareth down from the cross onto the hill of Golgotha, which is said to be the original site of Eden, where Adam himself was buried. The bones of Adam are to be found. So here, in a way, is the redemption of the past, of all of the earlier stages of earth existence, and particularly all of those phases that are ruled by Lucifer. All of this undergoes a process of redemption at this moment. And with this redemption, the etheric body of the earth is now filled with the essence of Christ, then and now. And we could say the etheric body of the earth is in a process of delicate expansion, that empowered by the Christ being, it is, as it were, becoming again more cosmic. Now, this is very good on the one hand. On the other hand, when the etheric body begins to expand and withdraw from a physical body, that means that physical body is beginning to die. And this is exactly what is going on with the earth, that we are now in the second half of earth evolution, and the earth, which reached a maximum point of densification, which reached a kind of prime in all that was meant to be earthly, now is beginning to excarnate. And this is partly the work of the Christ being, that this excarnation occurs in the right way. So we are, in a way, capable now, we have the potential of being far more in touch with the etheric forces of the earth than ever before. And now we can start to work with them and through them and help the earth take its next step forward, which is not preservation, which is not keeping it the way it always was before human beings screwed it up and so on, but very differently, it's to really help the earth take its next step. And this is what, for example, biodynamic agriculture is all about. It's a method that is needed in our time to work with a very different relationship of the earth's physical and etheric bodies. So this is something else that the Christ being has brought. And yet another was that with this second phase of cultural evolution, now it is the time that Ahriman has been given the rulership of the earth. He doesn't assume it all at once. In fact, there's a period of darkening of about 600 years, the so-called Dark Ages, in which, especially in the Mideast and Europe, there is a severing of the earth, of human consciousness from the spiritual world, a kind of shockwave of the mystery of Golgotha. And this is the time that we see the fathers of the church, the great scholars and thinkers and philosophers, trying to understand what happened and how can we understand this. And now we see the dying away, naturally or through force, of the pagan gods, all of these great, majestic religions, which were, as it were, under the patronage of Lucifer, they can't exist much longer. The Norsemen are about the last ones, at least in the Western Hemisphere, to be able to take this responsibility for their higher gods. After that, this is all gone. So we see now a kind of pralaya period in consciousness, if not in physicality, and the seeds of a very, very new relationship of the human being to the spiritual world. And what does Ahriman begin to bring? The capacity of thinking. So even a churchman like Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages has to prove God's existence by using the capacity of thinking. Now, in a way, it's Ahriman writing the rules, and everything has to be proven and understood in a very different way, a much more wakeful way, a much more conscious way, and little by little we find the unfolding of the scientific method into our time. And whereas Lucifer reflected himself vainly but gorgeously through the arts, Ahriman hides, does not want to see himself reflected, but hides behind technology. So what art was to pre-Christian times, technology and scientific discovery will increasingly become in our time and the times to follow. This is the sign of Ahriman's regency. But the difference is, before Christ, human beings had to be completely under the sway of Lucifer, with few exceptions. But Ahriman, who in certain respects is a much more powerful and formidable being than Lucifer, his regency, his influence, also has the necessary counterbalance of the presence of the Christ being in the etheric mantle of the earth. Now, there's far more to say about all of this, obviously, and I haven't taken history much further now than about 300, 600 AD. There's a lot more to be brought here, but that goes beyond the scope of this introductory course. And sometime in the future, I hope to take up aspects of history from an anthroposophical vantage point. But at least we've explored some aspects of the evolution of Earth and man, especially those that relate directly to the picture of life after death, the fourfold human being, the hierarchies. And we can at any time, as I've said, just switch from one of these lectures to any other, and I think that correspondences will arise.